Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Khalil Jashan, Vice President of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who examines the causes of renewed violence between Israeli troops and Palestinian demonstrators, claiming the lives of nearly 100. Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who discusses how state police, at the behest of the Democrat GOP-controlled debate commission, barred him from attending the Gore-Bush debate in Boston October 3rd. And Jelani Lawson, a New Haven, Connecticut alderman, who explains why he believes the war on drugs has been a failure, resulting in prison overcrowding and conflicts abroad. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that the momentum for gay rights could be threatened in the November 7th election. In several Midwestern and Western states, conservative activists have sponsored ballot questions designed to scale back gay rights. And many eyes will be on Vermont to see if the state reverses its law permitting civic unions for gay and lesbian couples. The most intense battle may be in the state of Nebraska, where Initiative 416 would ban recognizing gay unions and granting partnership benefits. It is also the first time in the nation that the Christian right has tried to use a public referendum to ban granting health benefits to the partners of gay or lesbian public employees. In Nevada, the anti-gay proposition Question 2 could swing the tight U.S. Senate race to the Republican John Ensign, in the contest to succeed retiring U.S. Senator Richard Bryan, a Democrat. Steve Wixon, director of the Center, a Los Angeles-based gay organization, observed, "Everyone here considers Question 2 a tool to get religious conservatives motivated. It's really a David and Goliath fight." Up in the Green Mountains of Vermont, partisan elections will provide a final judgment on the status of gay civic unions. The issue is front and center in the campaigns to re-elect Governor Howard Dean, a Democrat, and the fate of Ed Flanagan, an openly gay U.S. Senate candidate. Overall, many gay rights activists are becoming frustrated in fighting fundamentalist Christians over and over again. Oregon activist Gray Asher lamented, "They don't scare us anymore. What angers me today is how much effort and expense it requires from the gay community to counter these measures." By the early 1960s, like many cities across the United States, New Haven, Connecticut was on the cutting edge of reform. Mayor Richard Lee was determined to do something about poverty and get rid of the worst rundown housing. The city turned to urban renewal and tore down Oak Street and parts of Legion Avenue, and in the process uprooted over 3,000 people. As reported in Mother Jones magazine, the idea was to get residents of poor ethnic neighborhoods into decent housing. In place of Oak Street, Lee developed a highway connector to downtown New Haven and helped build a number of forgettable buildings: the city parking garage, a now decaying telephone building, the Knights of Columbus building, and the New Haven Coliseum. Today, former Oak Street residents say Mayor Lee destroyed a vibrant urban neighborhood next to downtown New Haven. Barry Vine, a former resident, told the magazine, "It was alive, it was exciting, it was always uplifting, it was our neighborhood." By 1967, New Haven was getting more urban renewal dollars per capita than any other American city, but urban renewal failed in New Haven. People continued to flee the city. By the mid-1990s, New Haven was one of the poorest cities in the U.S. and a national symbol of urban decay and misery. Through the 1970s and 80s, activists in many cities across the U.S. organized to fight the urban renewal trend and pressured government to fund community-based housing and businesses, with new jobs in neighborhoods abandoned by big banks and developers. 5 years ago, 2,000 journalists, printers, and circulation workers went on strike against the Detroit News and Detroit Free Press. The two daily newspapers, run under a single joint operating agreement, had demanded major concessions such as job cuts and creation of a merit pay system. Early on, the unions showed great solidarity and waged a massive campaign to get Detroit readers to boycott the daily newspapers. Combined circulation fell by 35%. But Gannett and Knight Ritter, owner of the two papers, were determined to crush the unions. In 1995, Detroit News publisher Robert Giles announced, "We're going to hire a whole new workforce and go without unions, or they will surrender unconditionally and salvage what they can." While the newspaper strike lives on in obscure legal battles, this summer the New York Times declared the long strike over, labeling the sometimes violent labor dispute as the last great newspaper strike of the 20th century. According to Extra, the magazine published by the Media Watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Times gave up on the story in 1997 after the striking workers offered to go back to work and later were locked out by the newspaper owners. Fair and other media critics say publishers provoked the strike as part of a deliberate strategy. Gannett and Knight Ritter wanted to impose what they called modern newspaper management techniques, disguising what was in fact an attempt to cut costs and undermine union living standards. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.
In the worst wave of violence in many years, thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel itself after Likud party leader Ariel Sharon visited Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem on September 28th. Running street battles between stone-throwing Palestinian youth and heavily armed Israeli troops have claimed more than 90 lives and injured thousands. Sharon's trip to Jerusalem, under the protection of the Israeli army, was viewed by many Palestinians as a conscious provocation. By his declaration that Israel holds absolute sovereignty over the ancient city, sacred to three major religions. But many say that Sharon's visit was only a flashpoint for long simmering frustration at years of stalled peace talks and lack of progress toward a final agreement creating a Palestinian state. After issuing an ultimatum to Yasser Arafat to order a halt to street demonstrations, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak pulled back from the brink of an all-out conflict and opened the door to U.S.-brokered peace talks. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Khalil Jashan, vice president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who examines the causes of renewed violence between Israel and the Palestinians and the prospects for reaching a peaceful settlement.
Although, you know, we have seen many in the media focus on the Sharon visit as basically the provocative action that the straw that broke the camel's back. But indeed, this uprising that we are witnessing in Palestine did not occur in isolation. It's basically the product of built-up feelings of frustration over the failure of the process. This is 9 years since Madrid. It's 7 years since Oslo. We just had a highly publicized negotiating session at Camp David in June. People's hopes and aspirations were raised sky high that an agreement is, around the corner, and then nothing happens. On the contrary, the situation continues to deteriorate. The Palestinians are pressured for more concessions. So what we have is basically kind of an explosion resulting from the frustrations of rising expectations over, mismanagement of the peace process and the lack of tangible results from the negotiations of the past 9-10 years. I mean, Yasser Arafat certainly is the president of the PA. He is certainly the highest-ranking Palestinian official within the Palestinian Authority. He has some influence. His popularity today stands at something like 30-31%. His party, Fatah, enjoys about 35% of the support of the Palestinian public. But an uprising of this sort is not started by like someone standing, with a remote control, pushing buttons to kind of send people out into the streets and call people back home. This is a genuine explosion of emotion, of frustrations, over an untenable situation, over continued occupation, over the fact that the Palestinians, 9 years into this peace process, not only do not see the light at the end of the tunnel, they don't even see the tunnel at the end of the light.
Was Ehud Barak's authorization for Ariel Sharon to visit the holy sites in the West Bank, was that somehow a capitulation to his right in order to overcompensate for his dwindling popularity?
Well, you know, Sharon's motives for the visit are very clear. I mean, he wasn't necessarily going on a picnic to Al-Haram Sharif or the Noble Sanctuary, as the Jews call it, the Temple Mount. He was there basically to derail the peace process, to send a message to the Palestinians that there is no compromise over Jerusalem, that there is no sharing of sovereignty over the city, that this is all mine, it's all ours. And to see him go up there, clearly with a green light from the Israeli government of Mr. Barak, clearly with the protection of the Barak government. After all, it took about 1,000 Israeli soldiers and policemen to secure the city in order to allow for his visit. That, you know, these soldiers and policemen are not under his command. They're under Barak's command and under the command of his Minister of Internal Security, Ben Ami, who is also the chief negotiator. So these people knew about it, and I think it was a very tragic mistake on their part to allow for that visit, knowing that that visit will totally not only undermine the peace process and antagonize the Palestinians, but will also undermine them as a government, and that's what happened.
What role do you think the United Nations and Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the UN, can play in this latest violence?
Well, we have been of the opinion that the United Nations should and can have a very important role to play in the continuing search for peace in the Middle East. After all, Israel was created through a United Nations resolution, and we feel that a Palestinian state should be created through the help of the United Nations, and the United Nations has a role to play. After all, the Arab-Israeli conflict is the story of unfulfilled United Nations resolutions that many of which Israel refused to implement over the years. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of sad to see the United States play games with the United Nations in the sense that we have weakened the United Nations. We don't even pay our dues to the United Nations, yet we use it to kind of advance our interest in this or that region. But we kind of have isolated and marginalized the United Nations when it comes to Middle East peacemaking. And yet when we get in trouble and we need some international support, we quickly resort back to the UN and forgetting that we are the ones who have weakened it and marginalized it. So now that we need it to play a serious role, it doesn't have the necessary credibility to do so among the different parties there. So, you know, Kofi Annan is a nice man. The United Nations has a good role and a responsible role that it could play in securing stability and peace in the region. But it should be strengthened and given a meaningful role in the negotiating process. The UN has been totally excluded, totally marginalized from the negotiating process since Madrid. So it kind of looks awkward now, just in a time of crisis and at this late stage, to say to Kofi Annan, please come and help. It would have been nice if you know, the United Nations has been involved all along.
That was Khalil Jashan, Vice President of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Contact the committee by calling area code 202-244-2990 or visit their website at www.adc.org. The October 3rd Gore-Bush debate in Boston may not be remembered for any candidate's brilliant analysis of issues facing the U.S. or a memorable line. Rather, the first presidential debate of the 2000 election season may be remembered best for the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates' decision to prevent Green Party candidate Ralph Nader from attending the debate either as a participant or a member of the audience. While Vice President Al Gore and Texas Governor George Bush sparred at the University of Massachusetts, thousands of Nader supporters rallied outside to demand their candidate be included in one of the three nationally televised debates watched by tens of millions of citizens. But the debate commission, established and run by the two major parties, set a minimum requirement of 15% support in selected public opinion polls for third-party participation. Nader, who had traveled to Boston for the occasion, held a ticket to enter an auditorium on the university campus to watch the debate with others on a closed-circuit TV. But the Democrat GOP-controlled debate commission had other plans. They ordered state police to bar Nader from entering the building, setting off a confrontation that Nader promises to bring to court if the commission doesn't offer an apology and compensation. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ralph Nader shortly before he delivered a speech at Yale University on October 4th.
So basically, the debate commission had control of the premises and not part of the University of Massachusetts, and they were excluding me on the grounds that if I didn't go away, I would be committing trespass. Now, I had a ticket, number one, not to the debate, to the adjoining auditorium where people would watch the debate. And second, I had a formal invitation to Fox News, which had a trailer right next to us, to be on their 11 o'clock show with Pat Buchanan. So I had two legitimate entry points, and they turned it down. And we went back to the periphery, the subway, and then we went back again past all the demonstrators in a bus again, and the whole thing went recycled again, and I went back. The Secret Service was, shall we say, embarrassed by the treatment I received, and they actually escorted us, even though they had no jurisdiction. They kindly escorted us and made sure that a police car took us down to downtown Boston, where the Fox News headquarters were, from which we did the show with Buchanan. This is clearly a political exclusion. It was, one might say, one of the worst blunders the commission has made in a history of blunders and displays of arrogance. And it will constructively rebound against them in the coming days. I'm going to submit an offer of settlement, and if not, I'll pursue my legal remedies. And the offer is a public apology from Fahrenkopf and Kirk on behalf of Al Gore and George W. Bush, who really run the commission. As you know, it's a private company created by the two parties, controlled by the two parties, and funded by beer, tobacco, and auto money. And along with a public apology, a charitable contribution to the Harvard Law School Project on Electoral Reform at $25,000, deductible. And if they do not agree to the settlement, we'll see them in court. We got them cold-handed, and all the exchanges on tape recorder.
Mr. Nader, if you could ask one question to the candidates, what would you have asked them?
Big business dominates our government, marketplace, workplace. They have too much power. Business Week had a cover story 2 weeks ago demonstrating that. How will you take power away from big business and give it to consumers, workers, taxpayers, and voters so they can directly assert their power, band together in trade unions and organized consumer and taxpayer groups to reclaim their country and shape the future? This question would have been followed by 3 minutes of stunned silence.
When it comes to the debate commission again, what's your view on how that commission should be reformed to make it more democratic and more accountable?
Abolished or marginalized. It's too corrupt to be reformed. Who are they? Two parties to hold the keys to the gateway to tens of millions of Americans, the majority of which have said on poll after poll they wanted a four-way debate with me, Buchanan, Bush, and Gore. We are going to establish a people's debate commission and get it underway next year. And it's going to work week after week to smash forever the iron grip that this debate commission has on access to tens of millions of voters. I've campaigned in 50 states, and some states more than twice, four times. I could campaign for 50 years and not reach the number of voters that George W. Bush and Al Gore reached last night. That's not fair. I'm attracting by far the largest audiences without bands, without food, and without buses. And they're paying $7 to $10 each to come to hear the politics of joy and justice from me and Winona LaDuke. Yet, if I don't get on that airwaves, I can't reach a fraction of the people that those two blowhards are reaching every day. So the Hartford Courant has started to cover this campaign day by day. It's the first newspaper to do so. I am just viewed as a feature story for the New York Times or the Washington Post, a every 2 or 3 week feature story. And unless we are given day-to-day cover, we don't have a chance to regenerate American politics. Now, why should we get day-to-day coverage? Because the Democrats are accusing me of possibly costing Gore the election. That's enough for day-to-day coverage. If anything more is needed, 37 years of achievement as a citizen builder and democracy builder, and an exemplary record in campaigning without soft money, PAC money, corporate money, just individual money, some of it coming through our website, VoteNader.com, along with all kinds of volunteers. And we're campaigning with citizen groups on the ground instead of looking for photo opportunities. And these are all the things that the editorial writers are complaining about in reverse. They're saying corrupt money. Okay, we're doing it right in the Green Party. Why don't we get a mention? They say photo opportunity, manipulating the press. Okay, we're there with the neighborhood groups, poverty groups, environmental, women's rights, civil rights, pro-public transit, anti-government corruption. Why don't we get attention? Because the oligarchy runs the country. This is the government of the Exxons by the General Motors for the DuPonts. And that's what we're trying to take away power from. They're not going to give us national media coverage when we want to break up the media conglomerates.
That was Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Contact the Green Party by calling area code 202-265-4000 or visit their website at www.votenader.org. Connecticut prisons, like many throughout the country, are bursting at the seams with prisoners who are there for drug-related crimes, including simple possession. As a result, 500 Connecticut prisoners were transferred to a maximum security jail in Virginia last year, where two inmates have died under suspicious circumstances. A rally sponsored by People Against Injustice was held in late September in front of the state courthouse in New Haven, Connecticut. The group condemns racism and discrimination against the poor that they say exists throughout all phases of the criminal justice system. Jelani Lawson, a member of the New Haven Board of Aldermen, is chair of the Black and Hispanic Caucus and director of the Better Way Foundation, which promotes substance abuse prevention and treatment. He spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about what he believes is the failed war on drugs and the lack of debate on drug policy in this year's presidential election.
The drug war is failing. You know, we're incarcerating more and more people. Drug use isn't declining. Availability of drugs isn't declining. The price of drugs isn't increasing. Drugs are, in fact, more pure than they've ever been. And so, at a minimum, it's time to acknowledge that, you know, something is not working and begin embracing alternatives.
Like?
I personally would be interested in seeing individuals in the legislature consider judicial discretion in sentencing. I think far too often you have individuals, because of mandatory sentencing, who, if they're not sentenced to long prison terms that don't address their problem, are certainly forced to plea bargain to something that they didn't do because of the potential of going to prison for a longer term than necessary.
What kind of efforts have happened so far in Connecticut to try to deal with this problem?
Well, in 1997, the state's Law Revision Commission, which is an official nonpartisan, bipartisan state body charged with reviewing the state's laws, came in with a report on drug policy in Connecticut. And what the report essentially says is that the problem of substance abuse is multifaceted. It's not just a criminal problem or a social problem or a health problem. It's all of these. So consequently, when dealing with it, we need a policy that's equally as broad. Right now, if you look at the laws that we have on the books, we focus primarily on the criminal justice system to solve what in many cases is a medical problem. Since the issuance of this report, the legislature has begun to take steps to reframe the emphasis of our drug policy, particularly with HMOs requiring them to cover substance abuse like they cover other chronic diseases. We've also taken steps to see that nonviolent offenders become eligible for parole earlier in their sentence so they can be reintegrated into the community sooner, kind of get back and become more productive members of society. There's also been some changes to some of the HIV prevention models that we use here in Connecticut, particularly with our needle exchange programs, which have been proven to not increase drug use and yet to cut the spread of AIDS and HIV amongst IV drug users by at least 30%.
this issue doesn't seem to be a huge one in the presidential campaign.
It hasn't been a high-profile national issue, and I think that's because the national candidates are terrified of the drug issue. You have to be tough on crime to embrace anything other than mass incarceration and lock them up, throw away the key. You know, it just doesn't respond to what they believe the public wants, and I think increasingly the public is saying, wait a second, this is America, right? Like, this is the land of the free. Why do we have 2 million prisoners? What's going on? You know, why are we spending $50 billion a year at the national estate level in a war on drugs that's not working? Is there a better way? I think that better way begins with restoring discretion to judges so that they can evaluate on a case-by-case basis what an individual really needs, develop individual treatment plans for people. I think we also need to look around the nation for models that work. Arizona in 1996 passed Proposition 200, which essentially said that if you're a first or second time nonviolent drug offender, let's try treatment and probation first. If that doesn't work, then maybe we move on to other things. But the first thing we need to try is treatment and probation. Same type of thing is on the ballot in California this year.
Just if you have a comment about how the Plan Columbia might impact on availability of drugs or in any way on the war on drugs in the U.S.
The thing about it, okay, so let's say we go to Columbia, we spend this $1.3 billion to eradicate the coca crop there. Well, then why wouldn't I, if I were a drug entrepreneur, why wouldn't I move to Bolivia, Peru, potentially Africa, Chile? I mean, there are all these other places that they can go to grow this stuff. You know, so I don't think it's going to destroy the market. I think it's going to disrupt it, shift it to a different place. Then we're going to start a war in Bolivia. You know, we're going to start a war in Peru. I mean, it's not working. What we really need to work on, I mean, supply reduction is one thing. We need to work on demand reduction. Clearly, with lifetime drug use being as high as it's ever been, we're not doing a good job of it.
Just real briefly, what are some of the ways that we could work on demand reduction?
Well, I think that you need honest drug education. We have this DARE program, and we bring in police officers to talk about substances with pharmacological properties. I think it's really interesting that we have law enforcement talking about drugs. I mean, it's kind of like bringing in a doctor to teach a training on firearms. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
That was Jelani Lawson, New Haven alderman and director of a Better Way Foundation. For more information, call the foundation at area code 203-777-0496. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Archibald Curry, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.